especially if his dog was in danger. Kane huddles in the shadows under a protruding slab of broken concrete. Beyond his hiding place, the night around him is a complex weave of scent trails, echoing sounds and movement. He stares, unblinking at it all, allowing the landscape to build before him, as much a map of the present as the past. The whispery crunch of a stone under boot, the leathery tap of a rifle strap on cloth, the heavy pant of excitement of a predator closing in on prey. His original prey remains, clustered with his pack, deaf to the danger approaching. Kane tracks the newcomers as they cut through old scent trails, even his own, creating a new one, stinking of man. It fully circles the others now, then draws tighter as they move in on their prey. Kane stays in his hiding place, unmoving, placing his trust in shadows. And one other. 9:22 p.m. Tucker crouched outside the fence, hidden behind a dumpster, his attention fixed to the feed from Kane's camera. Still following his original instructions, the dog remained focused on Amour's group, who continued to discuss where to spend the money in hand, where to eat a late dinner, and how to get more payments out of Commander Pierce. All the while, a deadly noose tightened around them all, even Kane. Tucker dared not risk calling his partner back to him. The movement would draw the commando's attention. As if hearing his silent worry, the view on the screen shifted as Kane glanced backward over his shoulder. The angle turned enough to reveal a commando in black body armor closing toward Kane's position. The shepherd remained at his post, as Tucker had ordered. Kane thinks he's hidden well enough, Tucker realized. But the dog was wrong. Night vision goggles hid the approaching commando's eyes. Kane's shadowy shelter offered no protection from such technology. In a moment, the shepherd would easily be spotted, along with the foreign vest. Then all hell would break loose. Tucker glanced up and down the street. Commander Pierce was nowhere in sight, and he had to do something. Now. Twisting around, he dove for the fence, to the gap along the bottom where Kane had crawled through. It was too small for him, but coils of razor wire blocked the way over the top. With no other choice, he placed his phone on the ground and dug with both hands into the hard-packed sand. All the while, he stared at the phone beside him, watching the commando draw closer to Kane. He dug faster, scooping out sand, deepening the hole, bloodying his fingers. Finally, unable to wait any longer, he squirmed his way through the gap. The loose tunic ripped on the fangs of the fence's lower end, exposing his Kevlar vest beneath. He reached back and grabbed his phone. The view of the video feed stopped his heart. On the screen, the grainy image of the commando jerked to a stop, plainly startled. And the reason was obvious. The soldier shifted his rifle and pointed it directly toward the camera. Directly at Kane. 9:23 p.m.
Damn that fool.
Seishan moved briskly, angrily, into the tiled lobby of the Hotel Juba. Kowalski followed at her heels. She hated abandoning Gray and hated that it bothered her so much, but in the end she also recognized the necessity. The pair had succeeded in drawing their tail to the steps of the building, hopefully leaving them unaware of Gray's disappearance. Still, she couldn't relax the tense knot between her shoulder blades. Gray shouldn't have gone out there alone. If they'd taken an extra few moments to plan, some other ruse could have been calculated to fool the ones trailing them. Instead, his action had been unusually rash, even reckless. And not just here. They'd come close to losing Tucker Wayne and his dog back in Zanzibar. Not a mistake Gray would normally make. And she could guess the cause. A deep current of fury and frustration still flowed through his core. She recognized it in the storm gray of his eyes, in the hard set to his jaw, in the clipped edge to his conversations. There was a manic edge to Gray that she'd never seen before, and it made her nervous. Not for herself, but for him. Maybe it was too soon for him to be out in the field. But they were committed, and there was no retreating from here. Kowalski slipped out a cigar and set about lighting it. A thick pall of smoke already filled the lobby, making her eyes sting. A soccer match played on a large screen television in the hotel restaurant, drawing in a boisterous crowd that spilled into the lobby and obstructed the way toward the stairs. Her partner nodded back toward the hotel's entrance.
Looks like our friends are setting up camp out there, making sure we don't leave.
Seishan glanced over at the trio who had followed them. They sat at a coffee house that offered a view of the hotel's front steps. Clearly, Amur intended to protect his investment, ensuring no other informant intruded on his territory. A loud cheer drew her attention back to the restaurant. The match between Brazil and Germany was heating up. A group of German patrons began singing their national anthem.
"Let's get out of here," she said,
intending to return to their rooms. Kowalski lingered, puffing on his cigar, adding to the pollution in the lobby. His eyes had drifted to the soccer match on the television. His legs drew him toward the machismo camaraderie of the live sportscast. At least that should keep him out of trouble for the night. She was wrong. Within a few steps, he bumped into a harried waiter holding aloft a huge tray full of teacups and pots of steaming water. The tray went flying, crashing into the mass of men crowded at the entrance to the restaurant. Shouts and curses erupted as scalding water splashed over those closest. Then a push became a shove, and a fist struck a nose. In a matter of seconds, bedlam broke out. The restaurant emptied into the lobby, escalating into a full brawl. Kowalski backed Seishan in a corner as a bottle flew past his nose and shattered against the wall.
"What did you do?"
Seishan scolded. Kowalski grinned back at her, keeping the stogie crushed between his teeth as he spoke.
"There's a rear exit through the kitchen. Let me get this party going full swing and you can duck back into the streets unseen."
He locked eyes with her. She read the sharper glimmer buried within that dim exterior. So she wasn't the only one worried about their partner.
"Are you ready?"
he asked. She nodded, which made his grin spread wider, a terrifying sight. With a roar, he turned and leaped into the raucous fray, a veritable bull let loose among the others. In moments, the fighting rolled like a tide toward the hotel's front doors and spilled out into the streets, spreading the commotion and chaos. Seishan twisted in the opposite direction, slipping out a scarf and wrapping her head and most of her face. Kowalski bellowed behind her, sounding disturbingly happy, finally in his true element. Now to find Gray. She had Tucker Wayne's call sign and last position noted on her own phone's navigation system. That's where Gray would be headed. She burst out the rear door, leaving behind the clatter of pots and pans from the kitchen, and into the dark silence of the back alley. Before she could take a step, a bright light speared her, blinding her. A harsh voice with a thick British accent accosted her, punctuated by the cocking of a pistol.
"Take another step and I'll put a bullet through your pretty skull."
Chapter 7. July 1st, 9:24 p.m., East Africa time, Busasa, Somalia. Standing by the fence, Tucker watched the rifle lower toward Kane. The grainy image on the phone set his heart to pounding. He'd never reach his partner in time. Reacting instinctively, he yanked out his pistol, a black Sig Sauer, pointed it in the air, and fired two rounds. The gun blasts stung his ears and echoed across the empty construction site. On the screen, the soldier's aim shifted away as he dropped low, startled by the gunfire. Tucker was already moving, heading toward Kane's hiding place. On his phone, he pressed a green icon in the shape of a small ear and lifted the phone to his lips. He spoke two commands, transmitting them to the receiver behind Kane's left ear.
"Take down! Disarm!"
The image on the screen blurred into chaos. Tucker continued to sprint, staying low.
"I'm coming, buddy."
Kane tastes blood, feels the crack of bone under the power of his jaws. He holds tight as a pained cry pierces the night, then a booted blow to his ribs finally knocks him loose. The night spins, but rights itself as he rolls his legs under him. His prey crouches, holding his limb to his chest, wrist crushed, gun on the ground. Both hunters face one another, but only for a breath. Kane dives low, snatching cloth at the ankle and throwing his body to the side, yanking the prey's limb from under him. The other falls, head striking broken stone. Goggles knock away, revealing narrowed eyes. Kane smells his fear, still tastes the blood on the back of his tongue. But the other is a hunter, too. A flash of a blade in the other hand. It stabs down. But Kane is already gone, spinning away, running low into the night. But not without a hard-won prize clutched in his jaws. 9:25 p.m. Gray sprinted along the barrier fencing as fresh gunfire erupted from the construction zone. The chugging coughs of automatic weapons along with the sharper blasts of smaller arms. A moment ago, as he reached the street, he'd heard the initial pistol cracks. Two shots. They had risen from a different part of the site, well away from the current firefight. Had to be Captain Wayne. This was confirmed when Gray heard Tucker's radioed command to his partner. There was no sign of the man on the street, so Gray rushed toward a gate at the next corner. He found it unguarded and pushed inside, his gun already in hand. A bulldozed road led straight toward the fighting. He spotted bodies on the ground, Amur's men. Gray ducked to the side, into the shadows of a pile of broken concrete. A commando stepped into view and kicked one of the bodies. An arm lifted off the ground, a pleading gesture. The soldier's pistol pointed down, a single crack, and the arm fell limply. They were killing everyone. As quickly as the firefight had started, it ended. The last few sputters of automatic gunfire died away. Gray sub-vocalized into his throat mic, "Tucker, respond?" The answer didn't come from his radio. A fresh flurry of gunfire erupted to the left, away from the pile of dead bodies. The commando in view dashed in that direction. Biting back a curse, Gray rolled around the pile of concrete and headed that way too. Gunplay spattered out as Tucker played cat and mouse with the hunters. Gray struggled through the maze, straining to track the gunfire while keeping a watch around him. At last, he spotted Tucker. The man, pistol in hand, ran along a row of parked dump trucks at the edge of the rubble field, trying to stay out of sight. Gray headed toward him, but before he could take more than three steps, a shadowy figure appeared a few yards ahead, his back to Gray, blocking the view. It was the same commander who had been slaughtering the last of Amur's men. The soldier spotted Tucker and fired a flurry of rounds at his target. Ricochets pinged off the dump truck. Exposed, Tucker tried to twist away, but a round struck him square in the chest, knocking him against the bed of the dump truck with a loud clang. He fell hard to the ground, his pistol flying from his grip. Gray raised his own weapon, strode two fast paces, and shot the commando through the back of the neck. The soldier collapsed to his knees, then to his face, gurgling harshly as he died. Gray stepped past him, kicking the assault rifle away from his fingertips. Ahead, Tucker struggled to stand up, a palm on his chest. Damned lucky the man had been wearing a Kevlar vest. But luck only lasted for so long. A fresh crack of a pistol came from the right, from out of Gray's field of view. Tucker ducked as a round buzzed his ear and struck the dump truck's huge tire. More shots rang out, blasting sand from between Tucker's legs by his left hand. Tucker scrambled away, disappearing from view. Gray hurried forward, but the shooter was still out of sight. Where? Then the commando burst into the open, running low, heading toward where Tucker had vanished, pistol raised forward. His other arm was clutched to his chest, his wrist held at an impossible angle, dripping blood. Judging by the wild blasts, fury fueled this attack. Gray struggled to fix the attacker in his sights, but the target was moving too fast, heavily armored. Gray fired anyway, emptying his weapon. But the soldier was so focused he didn't even flinch from the rounds pinging off the truck's side, even at a shot that glanced off his helmet. Then his target was out of sight again, pursuing Tucker. Gray ran forward, ejecting his spent magazine and slapping in another. In a few more steps, he spotted the gunman leaning over Tucker. His teammate, one shoulder bloodied, was sprawled on his back by the truck's cab. The armored commando held his pistol at Tucker's face, ready to shoot point blank. Gray couldn't stop him. Then a miracle happened.
9:26 p.m. The smoking barrel of the pistol lowered and pointed between Tucker's eyes. His shoulder burned, but not as much as his blood. He stared past the gun to the eyes of the assassin. He recognized the fury there. It matched his own. As the gunman ran up, Tucker had spotted his broken wrist, the ripped, bloodied flesh. He recognized Kane's handiwork. This was the commando who had threatened his partner. In the other's eyes, he read the satisfaction of the kill to come. It matched his own. And another's. A fierce growl erupted from the shadows, drawing the gunman's attention. His pistol jerked in that direction. Using the distraction, Tucker yanked out the rifle hidden under the truck, the commando's own weapon. He twisted the barrel forward and fired at the gunman's face, blowing him backward. As his body fell away, Gray appeared behind him, racing forward, then skidding back in surprise. How? Where did you get? Tucker, still on his back, turned to the shadows under the dump truck. Kane crouched there, panting, his eyes glowing brightly out of the darkness. As commanded, his partner had not only taken down his opponent, but also disarmed him. Tucker pictured his partner dragging the rifle by its leather strap in his teeth, ever obedient, obeying down to the word.
"Good boy," Tucker said, staring back into those clever eyes. "Good boy."
9:35 p.m. Gray headed down the street toward Hotel Juba. After he found Tucker, the pair had quickly retreated out of the construction area. They found no further resistance. With the mission completed, the remaining commandos, likely hired mercenaries, had pulled out and vanished into the night. Whoever had employed those assassins plainly wanted Amur silenced. His inquiries must have alerted the pirates involved in Amanda's kidnapping and triggered this swift reaction. Now Gray and Tucker were back among the street throngs in the new section of the city, stopping only long enough to bandage Tucker's shoulder. Luckily, the bullet had only grazed his upper arm. Tucker finished explaining what happened. From the video feed, I saw that Kane had retreated somewhere among these dump trucks and went looking for him. And you got ambushed. Tucker scowled and glanced down at the dog at his side. He'd stripped off the dog's vest and held it bundled under his good arm. I wasn't leaving him in harm's way, Commander. And I never will. Kane looks after me with equal diligence. I wouldn't be alive now if it wasn't for him. And you wouldn't have been in danger if you'd obeyed orders. But Gray let that lie for now. Tucker continued. Once at the trucks, Kane must have tracked me down, keeping hidden, closing in on my scent. And he brought you that rifle. Gray couldn't keep the tinge of respect out of his voice. I'd ordered him to disarm his opponent. He'd been trained well. Gray suspected such coordination went beyond training, that it had more to do with the inexplicable bond between dog and handler, tying them together by something deeper than just hand signals and spoken commands. Whatever the reason, they'd all made it out with only a few scrapes and scratches. Amur's group might have been killed, silenced by the hired assassination team, but because of Kane's help, they now knew the president's daughter was being held somewhere in the Kalmadal Mountains to the west. Before Gray could formulate a plan of action from here, he noted the tumult outside of Hotel Juba. Tables were overturned, stalls broken, windows shattered. Men sat in the street nursing injuries. It looked like the aftermath of a small riot. "What happened?" Tucker asked. "I don't know." Gray hurried to the steps of the hotel. He found the lobby equally ransacked. A televised soccer game played in the neighboring restaurant. A few men stood idly, sipping tea amid the carnage of tables and chairs, as if nothing had happened. Gray touched his throat mic and radioed both Kowalski and Seishan. No response. Tucker shared a worried look with him. Together they mounted the stairs. Their room, a two-bedroom suite, was on the second floor. Gray led the way down a tiled hallway, softened by a threadbare Persian runner. He kept his tread quiet as he approached the door. From inside, the cheers of an audience echoed out, coming from a television, likely displaying the same soccer match. Gray pulled out his pistol and grabbed the door handle. Tucker held a palm toward Kane, readying his partner. Gray burst into the room, only to find Kowalski sprawled in his boxers on the sofa in the suite's common room, a washcloth full of ice held to his right eye. Kowalski barely acknowledged them, still focused on the game. Gray searched around the room. Nothing seemed to miss. "Why didn't you respond to my radio call?" Gray asked. Kowalski stared sheepishly toward the table. His radio and earpiece rested there. He ran a hand through his wet hair. "I took a shower and forgot to..." Gray cut him off. "Never mind. What happened downstairs?" Kowalski heaved his legs to the floor with a pained groan. "You said to cause a commotion when we got here." "I meant a diversion, not World War III." Kowalski shrugged. "So things got a little out of hand. I gotta say, these Muslim guys, no sex, no alcohol, they sure needed to blow off some steam." Gray relaxed, holstering his weapon. "Where's Seishan?" Kowalski lowered the ice from his face, revealing a swollen, blood-red eye. "I thought she was with you guys." "Us? Why?" Gray's chest tightened painfully. Kowalski's next words only made it worse. "She left to go find you." Chapter 8. July 1st, 10:22 p.m., East Africa time, Busasa, Somalia. Seishan sat in a windowless, cement-block basement. A single bare bulb hung above her head. The space stank of bleach and had a drain in the middle of the floor. Never a good sign. Her left hand throbbed from where she'd sliced the meat of her thumb on a piece of broken glass when she was forced to drop on her stomach in the back alley. They'd immediately stripped her of all communications equipment and dragged a hood over her head. Forced at gunpoint, she traveled a few blocks by foot, stumbling along, then by open truck, judging by the wind, the sound of the engine, and the jolting of the suspension. She had to cling to the doorframe to keep her seat, her cut hand stinging with every bump. The gun shoved in her ribcage discouraged any attempt at escape. They'd gone no more than 10 minutes before stopping, so she couldn't be far from the hotel. But in the jumbled maze of the city, they might as well have taken her to another planet. Once here, the hood had been removed, and she'd been ordered to strip down to bra and panties and been thoroughly searched again. Afterward, her wounded hand had been tended, though blood still seeped down her fingertips and dripped to the floor. They'd allowed her to slip her sarong-like garment back on, but she still felt half-naked. She tugged at the plastic slip ties that bound her to a metal chair. She tried rocking, but her seat was bolted to the concrete floor. Resigned, she silently cursed her carelessness, placing an equal amount of the blame on Gray. If the bastard hadn't gone off so recklessly on his own. But she knew she bore as much guilt. She had acted no less rashly than Gray, and that troubled her, especially since she knew the cause. She remembered that kiss in the hospital, both needing each other but for very different reasons. Her carelessness this night was born out of that kiss. Fear for his safety, worry that she'd lose him, blinded her and made her sloppy. She should have known better than to run headlong into a back alley. Hadn't their pre-mission briefing warned of the rash of kidnappings in the city? The only balm to her ego was that her captors hadn't been pirates. The single door to the room finally opened. Two figures stepped inside. One carried a thick file folder, the other a chair identical to her own. The seat was placed in front of her, and the man who had ambushed her in the alley sat down, resting a file on his knee. He had short, sandy blonde hair, balding at the top, ruggedly handsome in his own way. His companion, a slender Indian woman with mocha skin and smoky eyes, took a post behind the chair, stiff-backed, one hand resting on a holstered sidearm. Like the man, she was dressed in khaki pants and a buttoned blue blouse, all crisply creased, giving the casual clothes the look of a uniform. Seishan locked eyes with her.
You were one of the three following us this evening, wearing the green sarong.
The woman gave no reaction. Seishan glanced between the two. She spotted an older photo of her, grainy but unmistakable, clipped to the folder.
Let me guess. You all have nothing to do with Amur Mati at all.
The man answered, his British accent polite but firm. I think I'll be the one asking questions. He flipped open the folder and glanced through the first few pages. Considering your number of aliases, I don't even know what to call you.
How about your worst enemy?
She said sourly. This earned the smallest uptick of the woman's lip, not out of amusement, but disdain. The man ignored her comment. Your employer committed an act of terrorism on our soil a few years back at the British Museum, orchestrated by a terrorist named, he sifted through some papers, Cassandra Sanchez. A nasty piece of work, that one. A chill iced over Seishan. Cassandra had been a guild operative like herself, planted beside Painter Crow before he was director of Sigma. Seishan knew little else about that operation except the woman was dead. Since her capture, Seishan had been struggling to determine who had ambushed her, running various possibilities through her head. She was on the watch list of multiple foreign intelligence services for her past activities with the guild. From the man's accent, she narrowed down the possibilities. They could be SIS, the British Secret Intelligence Service, but she caught the whiff of military about them.
You're SRR, Seishan concluded.
The man straightened, staring back at her. Impressive. The Special Reconnaissance Regiment was a newer division of the British Special Forces, established recently to engage in covert surveillance operations, specifically to conduct counter-terrorism actions. They were also the most selective and most secretive, and the only British Special Forces unit to recruit women. She stared at the Indian woman. Few knew anything substantial about SRR activities, but it made sense they'd employ field operatives in Somalia. Pirates had kidnapped several British nationals over the past decade, and the lawless rural areas of this country were the training grounds for a handful of Islamic terrorist factions. Unfortunately, she must have been swept up by their surveillance net by accident. The man confirmed this. We have facial recognition software hacked into the security cameras at the airport here. You were lucky it was us who found you. As I understand, the Mossad have a shoot-on-sight order regarding you. Seishan continued to put the pieces together in her head.
Your tail on us. It had been purposefully sloppy. You wanted us to know we were being followed.
And we expected you'd try to shake it, escaping out a back door and right into our hands. The man leaned forward. But who are you traveling with? The two men. We've identified them both as former U.S. armed forces, but nothing after that. Their records are clean, spotless, suspiciously so. Are they guild operatives or merely mercenaries for hire? Or were you using them in some manner? Seishan hesitated, unsure how to respond. No one knew she'd turned traitor against the guild and now worked for Sigma. Only a handful of people in the U.S. government even knew about her involvement. Her past crimes precluded her from being officially sanctioned, so if she were ever caught, like now, she would be denied. She was on her own, certain to vanish forever down some black ops hole. If you continue to refuse to cooperate, the man began, when the door exploded behind him, ripped off its hinges. A silver object bounced into the room. Seishan closed her eyes, wishing she could cover her ears.
The flashbang exploded in the confined space, searing through her eyelids and deafening to the point of nausea. She gasped out as it faded and opened her eyes. Blearily, she saw a small shape dash into the room, running low to the ground. She felt the brush of fur against her bare calf and the cold nose exploring her bloody fingers. "About time you got here," she croaked out, deaf to her own words. Gray and Tucker swept into the room, pistols in hand. The two SRR operatives were down on the floor, in postures of agony, having taken the full brunt of the flashbang's impact. Still, the female had enough wherewithal to aim her weapon at Seishan. Though sightless at the moment, she kept enough of her senses to free her weapon and blindly shoot in the direction of Seishan's chair. The muzzle flashed, and the shot sparked off the concrete floor, stinging her toes with stone chips. The shepherd leaped away from her chair, startled. Gray swung his weapon toward the shooter. Seishan yelled, "Stop! Don't shoot!" Tucker, closer, pistol-whipped the woman and dropped her to the floor, then collected her weapon. "They're British Special Forces," Seishan shouted, finally beginning to hear her own words as the effect wore off. Gray pointed to the pair. "Keep them down," he ordered Tucker, "until we can sort this all out." He turned next to Seishan, a small military dagger appearing in his hand. He rushed to her side and sliced her bonds free, careful of her bloody hand. As he crouched, he rested his palm on her bare knee, his fingers electric on her inner thigh.
"Are you okay?"
With her ears ringing, she still understood enough to nod. "I'm fine. He rushed to her side and sliced her bonds free, careful of her bloody hand. As he crouched, he rested his palm on her bare knee, his fingers electric on her inner thigh.
"Are you okay?"
With her ears ringing, she still understood enough to nod. "I'm fine. I cut myself on purpose. Made sure I kept the wound open as I clung to the truck's doorframe on the way here. Figured it was time for that damn dog to earn his kibble." Tucker heard, leaving a blood trail for Kane to follow. Smart. It wasn't smart. It was planning. On the flight to Africa, she had studied up on their newest teammate, ascertaining the dog's strengths and weaknesses, as she would any partner in the field. A report she read stated that a trained dog could distinguish a single drop of blood in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. She hadn't planned on testing that sensitivity, but she was more than happy to prove it true now. She gained her feet, still unsteady from the auditory assault, but at least she could hear. "What about the other SRR personnel?" "We took down one outside the hotel," Gray said with a worried look. "He's still tied up in the back alley, out cold. Kowalski has the other secured upstairs. Took him down like a battering ram when we burst inside. Might have broken his leg."
"Definitely broken,"
a gruff voice answered at the door. Kowalski stepped to the threshold and pointed his thumb toward the stairs leading out of the basement.
"Got him gagged and tied up there. So how much trouble are we in for kicking some British soldiers' asses?"
The answer came from the floor. The man had also regained enough of his senses to glare, teary-eyed, at them.
"I think your American colloquialism is a shitload."
He stared at the assemblage in the room.
"Who the bloody hell are you all?"
Gray holstered his weapon and offered an arm to get him back on his feet. "Someone who needs your help." The man took Gray's hand suspiciously, but he allowed himself to be pulled back to his feet.
"This is a fine way to ask for it."
Kowalski offered the only possible explanation.
"We're Americans. It's how we do things."
11:34 p.m.
An hour later, Gray had everyone gathered back at their suite at the Hotel Juba. They sat in the common room. A call to Director Crow, followed by a flurry of communiques between the two countries' intelligence agencies, facilitated some candid conversation. "The kidnapped woman out of the Seychelles," Captain Trevor Alden said, holding a steaming teacup in the palm of his hand.
"She's the president's daughter?"
"That's right," Gray said.
Amanda Gant Bennett. The two groups sat on opposite couches, Americans on one side, Brits on the other. A tea service tray rested on the table between them. Kane kept near his handler as Tucker balanced on the arm of the sofa, but his nose kept drifting toward a stack of tea biscuits. Captain Alden's eyes shifted to Seishan, seated next to Gray. "And she works for you chaps now." Gray simply nodded, not bothering to go into the complicated details of their professional relationship. Alden leaned back.
"Someone could have informed us all of this before you got here. Would have saved Major Patel a great deal of hardship."
Kowalski paced behind the sofa near the balcony doors, where the smoke from his cigar was less offensive.
"Sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have sacked him so hard, but he got in my way."
He shrugged, showing little remorse.
"But aren't you guys supposed to wear special berets or something?"
"Not on a mission. We're a covert team," Alden explained. "Just the four of us. Or three now, I guess."
Patel had been shot up with morphine and was sleeping in the next room, awaiting evacuation due to his broken leg. On the sofa, the captain was flanked by his two other associates, the Indian woman, Major Bila Jain, and a black, wiry soldier, Major Stuart Butler. Gray redirected the conversation to the problem at hand. "Captain Alden, any local intelligence you can supply us to help figure out where the president's daughter might have been taken would be most appreciated."
"No appreciation necessary. We've been ordered to offer our services."
Alden winced, then gently placed his teacup on the tray.
"My apologies. It came out less sincerely than I intended. I have a young daughter of my own. If she'd been kidnapped..."
Alden leaned forward and offered his hand. Gray took it and found the man's grip firm and dry.
"We have our full cooperation," Alden promised.
Gray found himself warming to the man. Once past the stiff British reserve, he seemed likable enough, and he had captured Seishan, not an easy thing to do. However, from the way Seishan sat with her arms folded over her chest, fingering the tiny silver dragon pendant at her throat with her bandaged hand, she didn't share Gray's opinion of the SRR captain. Likewise, Major Jain barely said a word, her features hard and unreadable, her posture rigid. Gray imagined the woman's head still ached from the effects of the flashbang, not to mention being pistol-whipped by Tucker. Not the most opportune way for allies to meet. Still, they'd all have to find a way to work together.
"Do you have any clues at all to the whereabouts of the young woman?"
Alden asked, getting down to business.
"Where she made landfall? Who took her?"
"Not much." Gray had briefly related their encounter with Amur Mahdi and the attack by an assassination squad in the construction yard. The captain was unaware of any of it, so Gray got him up to speed. Next, he reached to the table and unfolded a topographic map of the country. Alden leaned closer as Gray ran a finger along the mountain range to the west of the city. It cut clear across northern Somalia. "All we know," Gray said, "is that she was likely taken somewhere up in these mountains."
"That's a lot of rough territory. Jungles, chasms, caves. You could spend years searching up there and only scour a tenth of those peaks. Do you have any other intel?"
"We're still waiting for an NRO satellite to search the coastline for the raider ship."
"Needle in a haystack," Alden pronounced grimly with a shake of his head. "And they move those ships regularly. Even if you found it, that doesn't mean that's where the boat made landfall."
Gray couldn't disagree. He closed his eyes and replayed the conversation between Amur and his men. The man's group had been silenced for a reason. There had to be a clue there. Something useful. Then he remembered and straightened. One line of that conversation played out in his head. "A friend of my brother's uncle up near Eel. He says a white woman came through his village. He says they were moving her into the mountains." Gray opened his eyes and stared at the map. "Do you know some town named Eel?"
Alden nodded, studying the coastline. "It's a small place, a tough town, pirate run.
He finally tapped the map.
Right here, by this deep water cove.
One of Amur's men said they'd heard of a white woman, a hostage, who had been through that village. If we went to that town...
Alden cut him off.
You'd be shot on sight. And even if you did somehow survive, they'd tell you nothing. Anyone squeals there and it's an instant death sentence.
Gray pictured the last of Amur's men being shot. Still, Alden didn't seem despondent. If they went directly from Eel to the mountains, that could narrow your search. He ran a finger inland.
I'd suggest you call your director and ask him to have the NRO give up the satellite search for the ship and concentrate on this section of the mountains.
He marked off a box with his fingertip.
That's still hundreds of square miles, Gray said.
True. What about an infrared sweep?
Tucker offered. If the satellite can pick out heat signatures, narrow the search parameters.
Maybe. But as hot as it gets here in summer, those rocky peaks retain plenty of heat throughout the night.
Alden leaned closer to the map.
But I may have a better idea.
What? Alden smiled and glanced at the closed bedroom door.
I think I just found a good use for our poor Major Patel.
Chapter 9. July 1st, 4:55 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. Painter sat in his office, struggling with a puzzle that set his teeth to aching. Since this morning's briefing with the president, he'd been ensconced in his windowless office at Sigma headquarters, buried several floors beneath the Smithsonian Castle, yet steps away from the halls of power and many of the country's best scientific institutions and think tanks. Earlier, he'd reviewed the video feed from Somalia, listened to the audio recording. Without a doubt, Amur Mahdi had been executed in order to silence him. The CIA was already squawking about the murder of one of its local assets, even though Amur was clearly playing one side against the other. And in this case, the turncoat had gotten crushed between them. Still, the assassination of Amur offered further support to the idea that there was more to the kidnapping of Amanda Gant Bennett than simple piracy. Painter was sure of it. But what? So far, no ransom demand had been made. There continued to be no chatter among the various regional terrorist groups, no one claiming responsibility. If they had the president's daughter, they'd be crowing from the rooftops about it. So what game were they playing out there? Painter couldn't shake the feeling that Amanda's kidnapping was somehow tied to the guild. Perhaps she was being used as a pawn by a competing criminal organization to put pressure on the Gants. That is, if the Gants were indeed the true puppet masters behind the shadowy guild. He had a hard time balancing that with the raw fear he'd seen in the president's eyes, the anguish and grief in the First Lady's embrace of her husband in the hallway. Even Gant's uncle, the Secretary of State, had seemed openly sincere about finding Amanda. But that didn't mean other family members were not involved. He returned his attention to the large LCD monitor on his desk. Using a mouse, he scrolled through the long list of names glowing on the screen, each connected to one another by branching and crisscrossing lines marking family ties, marriages and births, even infidelities and children born out of wedlock. It mapped out the genealogy of the Gant family clan, stretching back two centuries. It was less a family tree than an interlacing matrix, so complicated it required being diagrammed out in three dimensions. Clicking and dragging, he spun the matrix in a slow turn, a spiral galaxy of power and influence going back to before the founding of this country. And it was still incomplete. He had historians and genealogists from around the globe working piecemeal on the puzzle to keep the project secret, building and spreading the true breadth and extent of this ancient clan. He doubted anyone had ever performed such a comprehensive analysis of the Gant clan. He also noted lines that crossed into and out of the matrix, distant cousins marrying back into the family. Not an unheard-of situation in such a powerful aristocratic family. It seemed generation after generation, no one wanted to drift too far from that wellspring of power and wealth. And what a wellspring it was. Painter had lost count of the number of inventors, scholars, statesmen, and leaders of industry that shone like stars amid the lineage, not to mention rogues and several persons of ill repute. But every family had its bad apples. He frowned at the screen, seeing his faint reflection superimposed over the matrix. Was the truth of the guild hidden here, or was it all a wild goose chase? To remind himself of the true nature of his adversaries, Painter clicked on an image file and brought up a symbol onto the screen, or rather a nested set of symbols. It represented the guild. At the center stood a tiny crescent moon and star. It was one of the oldest symbols in the world, going back to an esoteric order out of ancient Egypt. Enclosed around that, the more familiar square and compass, representing another secret fraternity, the Freemasons. And at last, circling them all, the shield of the Knights Templar, a medieval order infamous for its hidden mysteries. "The secret in all secret societies," he whispered, repeating the dying words of a guild associate. That was the significance of the nested symbols. It was said to represent the guild's path, tracing its treacherous footsteps deep into the past. The same dying man also suspected there were more levels and tiers, other secret societies, beyond those revealed in the old symbol, secrets continuing into modern times, leading at last to what he called the true bloodline, the ultimate masters of the shadowy guild. "One family," Painter mumbled, staring at the vast lineage of the Gant clan. To survive the scrutiny of time, the guild had hid itself within one secret society after another. Was he staring at the same subterfuge here? Was the true heart of this shadowy organization buried within the breadth and majesty of this family dynasty? If so, how many were involved? He studied the three-dimensional map, sensing he was missing something, that it stared him square in the face. But whatever nagged him refused to come to light. A knock at his door interrupted him. A tall, auburn-haired woman in dress blue stood at the threshold. Painter tapped his keyboard and wiped the Gant genealogy off the screen. It was meant for his eyes only. "Cat," he said, and waved the woman inside. Captain Catherine Bryant was his second in command, specializing in intelligence gathering services for Sigma. Painter pulled his attention fully to the present, to the matters in Somalia. "Have the Brits settled down after the mess in Busasa?"
"Barely, but the SRR has agreed to keep things under wraps and to offer their assistance out there."
"Very good.
But that's not the only reason I stopped by," Kat said. "I brought someone to see you."
She stepped aside, and a familiar face, draped in blonde hair, peered coyly around the corner.
"Lisa," he said, delight filling his voice.
He stood up and crossed around his desk.
"I thought you weren't getting back until tonight."
Dr. Lisa Cummings slipped inside, dressed in jeans and a loose pale blue blouse. She tapped her wrist.
"What time do you think it is?"
As usual, he'd let the day escape him. But he wasn't going to do the same with his girlfriend. He pulled her into a warm hug, kissing her cheek, appreciating how right this felt. She sagged into him, expressing a similar thought.
"It's good to be home."
They lingered in each other's arms for another breath until finally falling away, leaving only their hands clasped together. Lisa had been gone a week at a medical symposium. He hadn't realized how much he missed her until this moment. He guided her to one of the chairs and settled her there before letting go of her hand.
"I heard about the president's daughter," Lisa said dourly. "I remember her from one of those black tie affairs at the White House several months ago. She had just found out she was pregnant."
"Speaking of which," Kat took the other seat.
"Director, you asked me to gather information about Amanda's pregnancy."
Painter leaned back against his desk. He He had a full dossier on the president's daughter, but almost nothing regarding the baby she carried. He wanted every base covered. Something was odd about this entire affair, from the false papers to the trip to the Seychelles and now this kidnapping. He dared leave no stone unturned.
First of all, her unborn child is not her husband's, Cat began.
Painter's brows rose in surprise. This was news to him. Cat explained.
Apparently, Mac Bennett had fertility issues that required the use of a sperm donor and in vitro fertilization.
Interesting. Painter folded this new knowledge into the case, testing various permutations, different possibilities. Could there be some motive here? A custody issue? Where was this done? He finally asked.
A fertility clinic in South Carolina, outside of Charleston. I looked it up, very cutting edge, using the latest technology, with a client list from around the world.
And the donor for the child?
Cat shook her head. Confidential.
Painter hated loose ends. They had the tendency to unravel into a mess. Cat read his expression.
I can make some calls, but without a court order.
Painter shook his head. A legal action would raise too many red flags. Get others inquiring about Amanda's whereabouts. We can't risk that exposure.
Not to mention it would be a significant invasion of her privacy,
Lisa reminded him.
And in the end, the child might have nothing to do with this, Cat added.
Painter crossed his arms, unconvinced. Amanda fled to the Seychelles just a couple weeks before she was due to deliver, traveling under false papers like she was running from someone, or protecting someone.
You're thinking it's about the baby, Cat said.
But why? I don't know, but some answers might be found at that clinic.
I could send a team to investigate.
Or I can go, Lisa offered.
I'm an MD. Simple professional courtesy could open doors easier than a commando raid.
Painter's lips hardened. Lisa had helped Sigma multiple times in the past. Her medical expertise, especially in regards to Amanda's pregnancy, could prove useful, and likely why Cat had involved her today. And Painter had to admit that Lisa's suggestion made sense, risked less exposure, but he hated to put her in danger.
I can accompany her, Cat offered, possibly posing as a potential new client.
But you've got a newborn and a toddler at home.
And I've also got a husband with too much time on his hands, she argued. Monk can keep an eye on Harriet and Penelope for a couple of days.
Monk Cocolise, her spouse, was a former Sigma operative who had opted to retire so he could spend more time with his wife and family. He'd also had one too many close calls during prior missions and called it quits. I don't think your husband would want you out in the field, Painter warned.
It's not like I'm traveling halfway around the world. It's barely a day trip.
Cat's face betrayed her. Her eyes danced at the thought of getting her hands dirty again. After two back-to-back pregnancies, she clearly needed some fresh air to stretch her legs with a little field work. As proficient as she was in her role at Sigma headquarters, she was still a soldier at heart. She hadn't graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy and gained the rank of captain in order to be stuck in an office all day. He sometimes forgot that about her. He nodded. I can get you a flight out first thing in the morning. She smiled, glancing over at Lisa, who wore a similar grin. Painter realized the truth at that moment. The two women had played him from the outset, intending this result all along. Rather than calling them on it, he simply resigned himself to the inevitable.
We should return to my office, Cat said to Lisa. Get everything in order before our morning flight.
Lisa stood, gave him a quick peck on the cheek, and headed after Cat, but not before hanging back in the doorway with a smile that held infinite promise.
I'll see you tonight.
Painter watched them head down the hall. It was not an unpleasant sight. As they disappeared around a corner, the worries settled back over his shoulders. He reached to a file on his desk and slipped out the top photo inside. It was the last picture taken of Amanda, smiling next to her husband, one hand supporting her belly, protective, proud. Painter stared harder at the picture, noticing for the first time the edge of fear in her eyes, the way she leaned close to her husband, almost sheltering herself. Even the arm clutched around her partner's waist clung a bit too tightly. What were you so scared of, Amanda?
11:59 p.m., East Africa time. Kalmadaw Mountains, Somalia. The needle sank into Amanda's belly, delivering a burning sting of anesthetic. Her fingers dug into the thin sheets of the hospital bed. She watched it all, refusing to look away. Her hospital gown had been pulled up over her stomach, exposing her swollen belly and protruding navel. A privacy sheet covered her from the waist down. Not that they'd spared her from any indignities up to now.
That should numb her well enough, Dr. Blake, the tall blonde woman said, disposing of the used syringe in a red sharps container. She had a slight German accent, maybe Swiss. Thank you, Petra.
The British doctor patted Amanda's arm. Like his nurse, he wore scrubs, but rather than the typical blue, his were old-fashioned, solid white. We'll be done in a few minutes, and you can get some rest for the night. I know it's been a long day. The pair left to finish final preparations for the procedure. Amanda had no choice but to wait in the bed. She kneaded her belly, reassuring herself and the child inside. She noted the leather restraints hanging from the rails. It frightened her that they hadn't bothered to tie her down. It demonstrated their unflagging confidence in the security surrounding the cabin. She stared at the ultrasounds monitor, dark at the moment, but waiting to be used in the procedure to come. They'd already performed a scan of her abdomen when she arrived here, recording her baby's position, measuring the dimensions of his skull and approximate body length. She hadn't resisted that first ultrasound. At the time, she had wanted to know the status of her child as fiercely as the doctor had. In the end, it had brought her great relief to see the flutter of his heartbeat, his tiny curled fists, his small, sleepy movements. After a close examination of the sonogram, the doctor pronounced her boy wonderfully healthy. But it seemed the medical team was not done with her. Dr. Blake returned. Petra carried a tray holding a large syringe equipped with a 5-inch-long needle. Amanda already had an amniocentesis when she was 18 weeks along, so she knew what to expect. Petra swabbed her stomach with fresh antiseptic, then powered up the ultrasound and handed the lubed probe to Dr. Blake. With an eye on the monitor, the doctor guided the needle deep into her belly. The pain was minimal, like a mild menstrual cramp. She looked away from the monitor as the tip of the needle approached her sleeping child. It was too disconcerting to watch. One slip and she could only imagine the damage that might be done. In the end, all went well. Fluid was drawn skillfully from the amniotic sac around her boy and the needle withdrawn. She finally let out the breath she had been holding. Tears suddenly blurred her vision. Monitor her for fever, the doctor ordered Petra. Watch for any vaginal bleeding. Petra nodded. Dr. Blake turned to Amanda. There's no need for tears, at least not now. We won't have the genetic test results until the morning. Her first amniocentesis had been routine, done to rule out various chromosomal abnormalities like Down syndrome or genetic disorders like cystic fibrosis. But she knew that wasn't all the doctors had been searching for. Not then, not now. The note that sent her running from the States had warned of something genetically different about her baby, something others wanted to possess. She didn't understand much else, only enough to run before they came for her child. Blake continued. If the genetics are stable, your child will live, the very first of his kind. If not, well, we'll worry about such matters then, won't we? Again, that paternal pat on her arm. Even if results were stable, she knew awful consequences would be in store for her baby boy. and if they weren't, the medical team here would likely perform a late-term abortion. She turned her head to the side, not knowing which result to hope for in the morning. Tears welled again as her hands found her belly, but she was certain of one thing. With the last breath in her body, she would die defending her baby.
I won't let them harm you.
A bonfire in the outer camp glowed through the canvas wall, highlighting the crimson cross she'd noted earlier. Again, she saw the odd, almost fanciful decorations along its spans, a twisting and coiling pattern that traversed both cross pieces. Only now, after the amniocentesis, after the worries about chromosomal abnormalities, did she recognize the structures. They were helices of DNA. Genetic code. She stared, disbelieving. Coldness crept through her body. Though she'd never seen this cross before, she had heard whispers about this symbol, marking an ancient mystery that traced back to the founding of her family, to a secret buried at its heart. She had thought its existence a myth, a story meant to scare children. But now she could no longer deny the horrible truth. It was what that cryptic note had warned her about, what had sent her running to the Seychelles in terror. The bloodline. They found me.
Chapter 10. July 2nd, 10:12 a.m., East Africa time, airborne over Somalia. Gray adjusted the bulky earphones, muffled against the roar of the helicopter's twin engines. He stared out the cabin window as Captain Alden pointed.
There it is,
the British SRR officer yelled. The aircraft swept low over a sun-blasted rolling landscape of parched fields, broken red rock, and occasional patches of scraggly trees. Herds of goats scattered from under the pummeling wash of the blades. In the distance, a mountain range thrust into the morning sky, breaking the horizon into jagged lines. But the medical transport chopper would not be flying that far. Alden pointed to a large camp of tents and huts sprawled at the intersection of two gravel roads. The top of many of the tents bore red crosses. Parked vehicles, civilian cars, and United Nations trucks dotted the surrounding fields, along with many camels. It was a relief camp run by UNICEF and operated by the French organization Médecins Sans Frontières, known in the States as Doctors Without Borders. It lay sheltered in the foothills, halfway between the mountains and the ocean, acting as a way station for those living both inland and at the coast. A groan drew Gray's attention back to the rear cabin of the helicopter. Major Patel remained strapped in a stretcher on the floor, his morphine wearing off from the hour-long flight from Bosassa's airport to this medical enclave. The French doctors here would have no trouble casting his broken tibia and stabilizing him enough for travel back to Europe. But that was not why they'd really come. Patel's condition was merely a cover to explain this inland journey. Alden leaned closer, but used the radio built into the headphones to communicate.
I have a contact who should be waiting for us after we land. If any word of the kidnapped woman passed through the camp, he'll ferret it out.
Gray nodded and glanced over at Tucker and Seychelles. Kowalski was up front with Major Butler, who was flying.